I remember a time at which I had told my boss at the time, hey, I'm thinking about leaving because I want to do this morning brew thing. He convinced me to stay and just work on a different desk where potentially I could have more balance to what I was doing. Because at the time I was getting in at 6:30 in the morning, I was leaving at 8 o'clock. Like, it wasn't giving me much time to work on the brew. So I ended up changing roles for a little while, which was like a nice Band-Aid. But it's almost like once you have the thing you love doing, like the Band-Aid doesn't work.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Alex Lieberman is the founder and CEO of Morning Brew, which was recently acquired by Insider Inc. It's an extremely successful email newsletter where readers enjoy their business news in a more innovative and creative way. The brew actually started as a passion project for Alex back in college. And when faced with the decision between following a set path in banking or following his passion in building out the brew, he determined that there was nothing more important than following that passion and following his dream. I recently got to chat with Lieberman about his spectacular journey. Considering he started the brew from his dorm room at the University of Michigan, I thought it would only be fitting to ask about Michigan basketball and their success and predicted trajectory in this year's past NCAA college basketball tournament. Unfortunately, that didn't end too well for Michigan, but Alex's story is sure successful. I bet I know what you're going to be doing tonight around 9:57.
And it won't be sleeping.
No, I gotta imagine. Are you pretty psyched for the game?
I am very excited for the game. The only thing I'm not excited about is that I think the odds that I go to the Final Four if we win are about zero, given what's happening in the world. But no, I'm pumped. It's cool also that Juwan Howard, you know, coaching the team. I think he's the first coach ever who played on a number one ranked team in March Madness and is coaching a number one ranked team. So it's cool.
Very interesting. I actually didn't know, you know, I started, funny enough, a new company that creates podcasts for brands, and we're doing one for BetMGM, and our first guest was Jalen Rose.
Love it.
So yeah, and he was talking about Juwan, but it's funny. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the Fab Five and what happened there, but I'm hoping, man, I'm pulling Michigan. I think you guys might do it, man.
We'll see what happens. I will say I watched Gonzaga and Baylor, and they look very strong.
But tough.
We have this game to worry about first.
Yeah, that's true. Get through that. So let's talk about Morning Brew. You're a young guy. You started the business from everything I understand when you were back in college. And I want to go back before that. Growing up, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey in the suburbs in Essex County, a town called Livingston.
Livingston, New Jersey, of course. Well, now let me ask you this. Your parents, your father, were they an influence on you in terms, I know you went into finance and were interested in finance, but what was the influence your parents played for you?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I was just brought up in a household where family was always talked about as the number one thing. My parents never really honestly took vacations for themselves, the two of them. It was always when they went somewhere, we went there with them, my sister and I. When they went to dinner, it was my sister and I went with them. So there's always such a strong sense of like the family group growing up. And so I think because of that, obviously that was one of just my values. It's still obviously one of my values is just family is more important than everything. But also because of that, I just looked up to my mom, my dad, my grandparents, and what they did and what they aspired for themselves. And I kind of used that as a guide for what I wanted to aspire to do and be, because as a kid growing up, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I still don't know what I want to do. So my dad worked on Wall Street for 20 years for Citigroup in sales and trading. My mom worked for a Japanese bank in sales and trading. My grandpa worked for Prudential in sales and trading. So it was pretty clear to me at the time what I wanted to do, and that was to be in sales and trading. And so that was my dream early on. And so if you were to tell anyone that I was going to, at the age of 27, be running a media company rather than working in finance, they would have said, you're crazy. And so while I think my values that my family instilled in me from a young age continue to guide me, the exact trajectory looks a lot different than what I was initially expecting.
Yeah, it's amazing, right? I mean, with that type of heritage and history, but it sounds like your father, you know, also implemented in you really kind of a lot of values that are more important than just work. It seems like that to you, from knowing you, that it seems like there's a lot more to than just being a sales trader.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, my dad had such a big impact on me growing up, just from the standpoint of, you know, he would always repeat these things that were most important, like being honest, operating with integrity. And he would always say these things. And I think as I got older, like I truly understood what it meant to operate with integrity or not with integrity. And then in so many ways, like even though my dad passed away 8 years ago at this point, when I was right before my junior year of college, I think the lessons that he instilled in me, I continue to think about them, whether it's consciously or subconsciously, all the time. And I do think my dad's passing in so many ways has guided me throughout these years. In a lot of ways, there's no better or worse. It's making the best of a poor situation. But I don't think that I would have been working on Morning Brew if my dad was still alive. Would I trade Morning Brew for my dad? 100%. But unfortunately, I don't have that option. So I think it's just interesting to reflect on my desire to kind of make a name for myself, to take care of my family, and to be in control of my destiny absolutely comes from this place of my dad leaving this planet too soon, me feeling a lot of pressure that I put on myself, not that anyone else put on me, to take care of the family now. All I could visualize after that was money going out, no money coming in, because at this point, my mom was already retired. So all I thought about was all the money we're spending and nothing coming in. And I think in so many ways, I actually created this perception for myself. I'm really fortunate to come from a background where I probably haven't had to worry about money, but I think this game I got my mind into of really making sure everyone in my family was taken care of after this, because either that's what my dad would have wanted, or I need to make sure there was a sense of like someone running the family and stability. I think in a lot of ways that has guided what I've done over the last 5 to 6 years.
That's pretty amazing. And to think about it, and your father passing away, you're still in college, you're taking on this responsibility. I could imagine, did that cause you a lot of anxiety at the time? And is it even still there today? You know, some of the stuff that happens might, you know, it's traumatic.
Yeah, I think the way that I operate is, and you know, one could argue that this is a gendered thing where society has taught men to show emotions less. You could also argue just me growing up in a Wall Street family where emotions weren't talked about at the dinner table. It's a function of that. But I definitely think, you know, my reaction to all of these things was very much like put my emotions to the side, or in reality, what probably happened is like push those emotions deeper into my body rather than showing them and just like get to work. That's kind of been my mindset. And in some ways, it was a really productive thing, right? Like it was productive because, you know, my last 2 years of college were my most successful years of college after my dad passed away. There was an interesting dynamic there, both feeling guilty about that. Why did I do so well after my dad passed versus, but also I think I did so well because all I got was a sense of putting blinders on and doing the work that had to be done. Same thing with Morning Brew. It's like, I think it what created this almost like kind of crazy confidence in my mind. When any shit hit the fan with the business, I always knew we were going to figure it out. Like I had zero doubt in my mind that we would figure it out because we had to figure it out. There was no other option because at the end of the road, at some point in the future would be some financial outcome to take care of my family. Like that, I think, is what was in the back of my head. I think in a lot of ways, it was a positive because it focused me and it gave me a level of persistence and grit to kind of partake in the marathon that it would take. But I think in other ways, there have been negative effects where I think because my natural way has been to kind of push emotions and anxieties back, it has taken a lot of my own work to be okay with kind of bringing those out of my body because it's like such a subconscious thing now. So whether that be through kind of my own practice with a therapist, whether it's like actually taking the time for myself to kind of just ask myself, What am I feeling? Why do I think I'm feeling anxious right now? I think it's honestly taken a lot of like unlearning bad habits, not permitting myself to feel the feelings that all of us feel. But for whatever reason, when my dad passed and just other things in life, it drove me to pushing those into the background because that wasn't the priority at the time.
What do you think? Do you think if your dad was here now and saw what you've built and then obviously the outcome and selling the business or the majority of the business to Business Insider, I'm sure he's a guy who probably read the Wall Street Journal his entire life, you know, like
that what is for sure.
How do you think he would see it or think about it?
I mean, I think I would have to guess he'd be extremely proud. I think he would be a little bit mind blown by it because all he knew for 25 years of working in the business was starting at the most junior level of a bank, not coming from a target school, like an Ivy League. He went to Brandeis and just like literally working his ass off every day for 25 years. And I think he would be kind of mind blown by it in some ways, like building something where I controlled my hours, I controlled the destiny of the business and had a financial outcome that was a life-changing thing for myself and for my family. I think he would be mind blown. I think he potentially would have maybe said to himself, I wish someone told me this was an option when I was starting out of school. And no, I think he would have felt immense pride. And I just feel obviously proud to have known him. And I also just attribute all of what I have done to the way in which I was raised. Like I've just seen so many examples of kids being raised in really good ways and kids being raised in really bad ways. And I just see the long-term impacts of how parents raise their children. And so I just give so much credit to my parents and to just like any kid who I know was raised in a good way. I just give so much credit to being a good parent because it's a really, really, really difficult thing to do. And I'm not a parent, but I've seen enough of it to know how hard of a job it is.
Yeah, well, your parents obviously did an incredible job. I could tell just by talking to you. I'm trying to do one myself right now with two 11 and 13-year-old girls, and that's a whole wait till you get there. That's a whole new world for me.
You should talk to my girlfriend's dad since he had to raise three girls.
Oh God, I it's amazing. It's you know I'm a sports guy, and not that my girls they just don't play sports and. There's so much drama and it's just a difficult time now too with kids that are on their iPads and iPhones and obviously with the pandemic and, but geez, yeah, that I should talk to your girlfriend's dad, just get a little advice because it's getting tough. That's why I do all my podcasts now and outside of my home office, right? Just to get out of there.
No, but for sure. But I am sure you're doing a great job, but yeah, it's for any parent, it's tough. It takes a lot of work. And there's a lot of research and resources, but there's not one playbook that works.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And again, you know, knowing what you've done and where you've come from. And so were you set on always while you were in school being a sales trader? I mean, was that definitely what you were going to do after college?
Yeah, I think that was what I was always planning on doing because there wasn't ever any other option in my mind. It's like almost once I knew that that's what my family did, it's in a weird way, or I just don't think I was open-minded to anything else. Like a lot of kids in school were applying for banking jobs, which actually was, I would say, the most competitive role out of Michigan. For whatever reason, I didn't even consider going into banking. Same thing with like people who were recruiting for consulting or marketing. I think in a lot of ways, I actually probably would have liked something like marketing more, given I would generally define myself more as a creative than as like a quant type person. And I almost think in some ways, I didn't give myself permission to be open to these other things because I just was like, I need to be like my parents. This is what they did. This is what I'm doing. And so like growing up, I had be the best trader in the world written on my whiteboard. It's like one, what kid at the age of 15 has that written on their whiteboard? But for whatever reason, I put so much pressure on myself to do that one thing. And up until starting The Brew, which we started in September of 2014, or like the actual thing came out in March of 2015. Up until then, like that was my plan, was to go into trading. I had gotten my job to Morgan Stanley. I had signed my full-time offer for after I graduated. Like that was the grand plan, was like, I didn't even have a plan after that. Maybe it was to work at Morgan Stanley for the rest of my career. Maybe it was to go work at a hedge fund. But it was like, that was peak in my mind because that's all I knew that I wanted to do.
Where do you think that drive, like you said, you were 15 or younger, and you had that on your whiteboard, right? Like where's that drive come from?
I definitely think It's like the question of any of these things with nature and nurture. I think part of it was, I would say part of it is nurture for sure. I would actually attribute way more of it to nature. I think being around, like playing a lot of sports growing up and loving competing in team environments. I think being in a Wall Street family with people who are also competitive. I also think like even growing up, and I was always like the youngest in my class in school. I went to a private school in New Jersey. I was always the youngest because most people were held back. So I was usually like almost a year younger than people. I was like bullied in middle school and even high school. I think that put a lot of a chip on my shoulder. I think there were just random occurrences in life of this combination of competition, but also chips on my shoulder that just continued to add up, where it's just like, I felt like I had something to prove to the world because either I'd been done wrong in some way, or I'd just been taught from a young age, it's about competition. By the way, I don't know if that's actually a good thing, but I just think that's the way that I grew up.
Oh, that's you. And like you said, you know, that's going through a lot of hard things, but that probably drove you in a lot of ways. And that's what happens, right, in life and how you go about it. So take me back. So you're at Michigan. How was the basketball team at the time when you were there?
We were a basketball school the entire time that I was there. Like Michigan football is still a big question mark, but it was like my sophomore year, we went to the finals. One of my other years in school, I believe we went to the Elite Eight. Like we were a good basketball school. Yeah. But yeah, I was, you know, I was in the business school at Michigan. I did the classic internship things. So after my freshman year, after my sophomore year, after my junior year, I did internships in finance. And like I was saying, I got into my senior year at Michigan. I had already signed my job offer to work at Morgan Stanley full-time. So I had my job that I knew I was going to have leaving Michigan after graduation, only had to take a few classes. And so I decided I needed to spend my time doing things other than playing FIFA and playing video games. And so I started helping other students who were re-recruiting for jobs in finance to prep for job interviews. And I would do mock interviews and I would always ask these students, what do you do to keep up with the business world? And every student would have the same answer. They'd say, you know, I read the journal and I read it because I feel like I have to, because that's what my parents told me to do. And it's a prerequisite to say you're well-read in business. And at some point I was just like, this is crazy. You shouldn't feel like you need to, or you have to read something because you've been told to do it. You should do it because you enjoy it, because it's about the subject matter of the career you're going to spend the next 50% of your life in. And so I started writing a daily business newsletter. At the time, it was called Market Corner. It was created in a PDF using a Microsoft Word template. It looked ugly. The writing was fine. It wasn't great. I wasn't a great writer. And honestly, in the business program, when I was at Michigan, I didn't have to write a lot. So I didn't get to practice it a lot. And I just started by sending this newsletter out to a group of students that I had been helping with job interviews. And I would just attach this PDF each day. I think the first Market Corner went out at some point in November of my senior year. And that was the MVP. That was the first product where I was like, okay, there's something to this, because it was a PDF. There was no website. If you wanted to sign up for it, you had to email me or text me saying, hey, can you sign me up for your listserv? And I had to go plug your email address in manually, yet a couple thousand people signed up for it.
Wow.
And to me, like again, small numbers, but in the context of Michigan's business school with a product that was impossible to subscribe to, it showed that there was clearly pent-up demand for something better. And what I was serving them wasn't that much better. And so like in my mind, if I could make something that much better by actually leveraging the skill sets of other people, it could be incredible. And so that's when it was over winter break of my senior year, brought on Austin Reif as my co-founder. He was originally a reader of Market Corner, 2 years younger than me, actually in the same fraternity, but we didn't know each other through the fraternity.
Did you know each other at all before you brought him in, or he was just like a reader?
Yeah, he was a reader. And he basically emailed me. I still have the emails where
that's great.
The original exchange where I had emailed all my readers basically being like, hey, I'm looking for people to help out with Market Corner. If you have thoughts or ideas for the newsletter, let me know. He emailed me saying he has thoughts or ideas. I said, let's go sit down in the main area of the business school so I can get a sense if you can actually commit the time to it, which is like such an ironic thing. And so we ended up talking a lot about how the product could be better, and officially brought him on as a co-founder either over winter break or in January of 2015. And the first Morning Brew, like as a proper email newsletter, went out in March of 2015. And that was the start. And we've been at it for 6 years now.
Yeah. How'd you come up with the name?
So it was a combination of doing a lot of brainstorming, but also bringing in who I thought was like my most creative friend. And so, you know, to this day, we've always said that like this friend who I'm still very close with will end up like hunting me down for equity in the company because he helped come up with the name. And so literally all we did is we basically just said like, what is the feeling that we want this newsletter to give off? We said, we want it to wake you up. We want it to wipe the crust off your eyes when you're on the subway. We want it to give you energy. Okay. That came up with words like caffeine, coffee, all these things. And then we just literally just jotted down probably 500 words that we associated with the feeling we wanted the newsletter to give off or when it was being delivered in the day, how many days a week. We just started combining words and getting a sense for what felt right. And Morning Brew stuck. The time, the original website was morningbrewdaily.com because the domain for Morning Brew was too expensive at the time. I think it was like $20,000 and we didn't have $20,000 to spend on the website. If we wanted to buy brew.com, it was $100,000 and morningbrewdaily.com was like $4. So it was a no-brainer. Yeah. And then we later, as the business grew, obviously bought morningbrew.com.
I'm sure the guy got a lot more than the $20,000 that he wanted initially.
Yeah, exactly. And we never bought brew.com, but I'm very interested what that eventually sold for because someone owns it now that didn't own it when we originally looked at it.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
As many of you know, a large and rewarding part of being an entrepreneur is getting to go around pitching clients, not only locally and domestically, but even abroad. However, in the unfortunate chance that you need to make an emergency visit to the hospital to seek medical attention, your health insurance may not cover the full cost of an emergency medical flight to a hospital or trauma center. It's definitely something I've thought about as I do a lot of travel. Even if you have a comprehensive coverage, you could still get hit with substantial deductibles and copays. There is a solution to this problem, however, with Air Medcare, a membership that protects you and your loved ones from all out-of-pocket expenses for medical air transport when flown by an AMCN provider. Best of all, it's affordable. Membership covers your entire household for as little as $85 a year. Literally, that's just pennies a day. In this podcast, we discuss how successful people prepare to face and overcome challenges. An Air Medcare Network membership can help you plan for the unexpected so you can take on your day as an entrepreneur anywhere you go without the fear of transportation costs in the event of an emergency. As a bonus, How Success Happens listeners get up to a $50 e-gift card when they join today. Visit airmedcarenetwork.com/success and use offer code SUCCESS.
And our next sponsor.
Hey, business owner, did you know that over 4.2 billion people are active on social media now? That means if you want to connect with your customers or find new ones, you need social. If you want to build loyalty and stand out from the competition, you need social. And if you want to make using social media easier, more impactful, you need Hootsuite. Hootsuite is the must-have tool for managing and growing your business on social. Hootsuite makes it easy to find your audience, whether on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, or Pinterest. You can schedule content, publish posts, and track your success all in one place. Millions of businesses around the world are already using Hootsuite to supercharge their social efforts. And now it's your turn. Go to hootsuite.com/HSH to start your free trial and get 50% off your first year. That's hootsuite.com/HSH for a free 30-day trial and 50% off your first year.
And we're back.
You had this job lined up. Did you just go and start Morning Brew?
So I went and joined Morgan Stanley because when I graduated Michigan, I want to say we had 10,000 subscribers. So we had a fair bit. We had an audience. We didn't have a company. And so when I graduated Michigan, I didn't feel comfortable going to my mom at the time and being like, hey, you know, this job that I've wanted my entire life, I'm going to actually renege on my offer and go do this media thing where we don't know how to make money and we have 10,000 people reading this email newsletter. And so went, joined Morgan Stanley, started in June of 2015. Stayed there until September of 2016. And right after Labor Day of 2016, I quit and went full-time on The Brew. And it's funny, like I would say 8 months into being at Morgan Stanley, I realized things didn't feel perfect. I felt like I was diluting my time, spending 70% effort on Morgan Stanley, 30% effort on Morning Brew. I didn't feel like I was doing either exceptionally well. That was a bad feeling because I wanted to feel like I was doing well in whatever I was doing. I wasn't necessarily loving the work that I was doing at Morgan Stanley. Like I said, I'm naturally like a creative. I like building things and I was trading a product that was super quantitative in nature. I was the only person on the desk that wasn't a math major. I think what kept me there was one, just like an allegiance to a commitment I had made, but also being around really smart people. You know, there were super smart people on the desk. And then I remember a time at which I had told my boss at the time, hey, I'm thinking about leaving because I want to do this Morning Brew thing. He convinced me to stay and just work on a different desk where potentially I could have more balance to what I was doing. Because at the time I was getting in at 6:30 in the morning, I was leaving at 8 o'clock. Like it wasn't giving me much time to work on The Brew. So I ended up changing roles for a little while, which was like a nice Band-Aid, but it's almost like once you have the thing you love doing, like the Band-Aid doesn't work. And so then ended up leaving in September and have been building since then.
Let's just say you didn't start Morning. Just let's say that never happened and you went to work, you're a sales trader, and you realize it's not your thing. Like, what do you think you would be doing right now?
It's a great question. It's honestly a scary thing to think about because when I think about my skill sets, like what I'm good at and what gives me energy, sales and trading is not the thing. Like I think I wouldn't have been an A+ employee in sales and trading. And now, almost six years out of college, like by that point in time, something would have had to have changed. Like I couldn't have just been mediocre for 5 years. I would have either gotten fired or felt really unsatisfied about myself. So what I could imagine is I would have changed something. I would have either gone back to business school, but I probably would have said no to that because I don't necessarily know the value added of going to get an MBA after getting a BBA. So honestly, I may have done like a full career pivot and just moved into something that was like more what felt more creative and entrepreneurial in nature, whether that was working in marketing or just something that felt like I was building. That is, I don't know everything that I love doing. I definitely know things I don't love doing. But if you were to ask me like, what is one thing I love doing? It is being creative and it is building new things that haven't been done before. And so I would have looked for something that allowed me to do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just relate my own story. I didn't know what I wanted to do after school. I went to work at Lehman Brothers. I was there 6 months and everyone's like, you should stay here. It's the safe bet. Cause I was like, I want to go work in sports. I want to do something in sports. And it's really funny. I mean, what happened, not funny, but obviously the safe bet wasn't the safe bet, but it's always interesting to think where you might land. So when was it when you ripped the Band-Aid off and finally just started going full steam?
So it was right after Labor Day, 2016. It was just me. I was working out of coffee shops for several months by myself, wasn't taking a salary, really fortunate in the fact that my mom covered my rent for, I want to say 6 months or a year. And yeah, I was just working on putting out the newsletter, growing the audience. Austin was still in school because he's 2 years younger. So he was in his senior year. Once I decided I was going full-time, he knew he was going full-time also. So he rejected a full-time job offer to work in banking. And yeah, basically it was kind of figuring out, I would say when I quit, the next 6 months we're figuring out what was our plan for actually making this into a business. And that's when we really thought about just like this framework of thinking about how do we make this newsletter thing into a company? And it was write, grow, sell. It was 3 steps. Nothing else mattered beyond those 3 steps. Create the best daily business newsletter for modern business leaders or millennial professionals, bar none. We don't do that. Nothing else matters because without a great product, you're nothing. The second was grow. How do we, once we have the right content, get qualified, the right eyeballs. So like the 28-year-old who's working in a large city, who works in tech, finance, or consulting, how do we get make sure every one of those people knows about our newsletter? And the third step was, once we have a lot of those people, how do we convince brands small and large to pay us money to tell their story in front of our audience? And basically it was that flywheel. And we focused on just doing that flywheel basically from the beginning of 2017 to the beginning of 2019. We did nothing other than that flywheel for over 2 years. And I think that was really good in that it focused us on doing one thing exceptionally well before going into other things. It also focused our hiring because we only ever hired if it helped one of those stages. But we also, you asked, you know, what did we do in the early days? We also raised a little bit of money because we knew step three, like actually selling advertising, wasn't going to happen day one. But it was, you know, a chicken and the egg problem, because if we wanted to create great content, we needed people to write that content other than Austin and I, or like a marketing person to grow the audience. And so we raised $750,000 from family and friends to hire into steps one and steps two, which would give us the ability to make step three happen. And we knew once step three happened, we would be able to get the flywheel moving faster, because by then making money through advertising, we could reinvest that money either into growing the team, so to have more people supporting steps one, two, and three, or spending money on paid marketing so we could grow the audience faster. So then we could ask more for advertising dollars.
Who was your first advertiser? Do you remember how much they paid you?
Yeah, I do. So first advertiser was M. LaHart. Yeah, it was M. LaHart. It's a brand for graduation gifts for college students. So like branded watches, cufflinks, et cetera. They paid. So the way we got that deal was one of our investors had sold his media business to a media agency. And so he was basically able to convince one of the clients of this agency just to throw us a bone. He literally referred to our first ads as like beer money for Austin and I. It was $800 a spot. So they bought three spots for $2,400. And just for context, like if a brand wants to do a full takeover of Morning Brew's newsletter today, it's over $100,000.
Yeah, they got a deal. So at that first time right then, how many actual readers did you have?
So when I quit, we had 35 or 40,000 readers. Wow. When we started making money, I want to say we had 75,000 readers. And then, you know, the real growth happened in, I always get my years messed up, but I believe it was 2018 to 2019, when we went from 100,000 subscribers to 1 million subscribers. That happened in a year. And that was a function of, because we started making advertising dollars towards the end of 2017 and early 2018, we started pumping most of that money into paid marketing. And so the size of our audience grew by 10x. And so then we were able to, we literally just grew, we charged brands linearly for how we grew. And so you can imagine that, you know, our advertising revenue 10x'd in that year also. I believe, yeah. I always get the years wrong, but I believe it was, we went in that year, we got to $13.5 million in revenue from $3.5 million.
Yeah, wow. That's such a great strategy too, than just putting it back in and growing your audience. To me, it's such, first off, it's a short period of time. It's an amazing story. The outcome's amazing. The growth's been amazing. It sounds like, what were some of the challenges? Did you ever have thoughts when you went full time? Like, you know, it sounded like you were gung-ho. Like, did you ever back off of that?
I would say the biggest challenges for me personally was staying focused. And I think in so many ways, that's why I was really fortunate to have an amazing partner in Austin. Because Austin very much is just like a focused worker, right? Like he thinks of things very linearly. And so I think that was really important, because my 15 ideas, although maybe great ideas, weren't necessarily the best way to allocate our time or resources. And so I think it actually was a really good kind of 1-2 punch of like me expanding how we thought about our business horizontally a lot, but then having Austin to help us refocus on like what is the most important one or two things. And that honestly, that's I think the biggest thing that I've learned from him as just a partner and a co-founder is I used to think about my creativity and my crazy brain as like a weakness, because I would procrastinate a lot. I would kind of be all over the place. I was the classic person who would lose his car keys and his wallet. But I think in some ways, like that is my superpower. But I think when people talk about should you spend time tripling down on your superpower or spending time on your weaknesses? I actually think it's a nuanced answer. I would say generally it's to triple down on your superpowers, but your weaknesses can't be weak enough to hold back your superpowers. And so to me, it's like getting an education on being good enough at focusing, being good enough at prioritizing to not hold back the potential of big ideas was a really important balance for me to become comfortable with.
Yeah, no, that's such a great way to put it, and just how Austin, in terms of being able to kind of keep you along the lines where you could use those superpowers. You know, it's funny, it reminds me, I've had a business partner, we've started and sold two businesses, very much reminds, we're very much in that mold of, he's great at keeping me grounded because I have these ideas, I want to do all these things. And he just knows how to keep it grounded and focused and for us to do well. And if I didn't have that or never had him as a partner, I would be floundering. There's no doubt, just in my situation. So take me now. So you guys scale up really quickly. And within, I guess, another year, 2020, how does Business Insider, Insider Inc., they come yeah, knocking on your door? How did that happen?
Yeah. So I think this in a lot of ways just plays into just one of my fundamental beliefs on the value of not just the value of network, but the value of like quality network. And it's funny, just as an aside, I was doing some research today. Your listeners will find this interesting, on a company, Pinduoduo. I don't know if you ever heard of them, but it's the largest company no one's ever heard of. It's the 50th largest company in the world.
Wow.
Worth $200 billion, was founded in 2015. By this guy, Colin Wong. And the reason I bring him up is not only because his story is absurd, but remarkable about his upbringing is by the age of 25, he had the most qualified network of mentors that I've ever seen. He rubbed shoulders with Bill Gates, Larry Page, Warren Buffett, and three other deca billionaires in China. And I just think in so many ways, like that is what leads to great opportunity and great decision-making. And the reason I say that is when it comes to the Business Insider deal, you know, one of the people that was in our network before the deal even came close to manifesting was someone senior at Insider. So in 2018, I think it was in early 2018, we were still in the point of trying to complete that flywheel of right, grow, sell, right, grow, sell, right, grow, sell. And one of the things we were trying to do to get our audience in front of, or our newsletter in front of new audiences, was partner with big publications who would, for some reason, agree to publish our newsletters on their websites. And so I remember having a conversation with, at the time, the executive editor of Business Insider, trying to forge a partnership where they would publish Morning Brew on their website every day. And the hope was that they would want more content that was good content, and we'd be able to use it as like a lead gen tool to get subscribers. And I bothered this executive editor enough where they foisted me on this other person. They're just like, this is too much. Like, it's your problem now. The person they introduced me to is this guy, Claudius Senst, who at the time had just, he had been working for Axel Springer, the parent company of Insider. Yeah. He joined Insider to run their consumer subscription business because in Business Insider Prime was still small, but they saw opportunity in it. And we just started building a relationship. We met up, we got beers on Stone Street in the financial district. We just talked about like media, life, honestly, not a lot of work related things. And then over the coming, call it year and a half, we just kept in touch. We did home and home ping pong matches.
Wow.
We just kept talking about just like the world of media. And then in the beginning of 2020, Claudius had continued to grow within Insider. I think at the time we started talking again, he was the chief of staff to Henry Blodgett. Now Claudius is the COO of Insider. But he had brought up that maybe it would be worth having a conversation about us to partner in a more meaningful, deeper way. And the original, I think, reason he wanted to have the conversation is he saw so much complementary content that we were creating, where Insider was great at creating great web content that was SEO optimized. They had grown massive social accounts. So they were great on social and like website content. But as it related to like email newsletters and podcasts, they really had no experience at all. But those were competencies they really wanted. And so that's where the conversation started, was just like that we had complementary competencies as businesses. And then started in the beginning of 2020, then everything in the world happened. And there were, Austin and myself had never done a deal before. So we had no idea what the typical lead time was or how many ups and downs there were. But there was definitely kind of these ebbs and flows where it felt serious to not being that serious to getting very serious. And we ended up doing a deal officially in October of 2020. And we feel really good about who we decided to partner with.
Well, it's great. You know, you sound like you spent a couple of years getting to know each other, which is from a personal level, which is most important. And I mean, that obviously set you up to know that what you did felt right and seems like it's right. So you're talking October 2020. How's it been since the, acquisition, or I guess they bought a majority of the business?
Yeah. So I would say, first of all, in terms of our relationship with Insider, nothing has changed. Like everything that they've said that they were going to do, they've done, which is in a lot of ways, let us do our thing.
Yeah.
But be there to support us whenever we need it, which honestly is like the best thing you could hope for in a partner, which is like, we're entrepreneurs. We want to continue to build our business, but we don't want to feel hamstrung or told what to do. And so they've been great about letting us execute on our plan, but then trying to support us in ways of partnering to try to drive growth and all of these things. I would say actually like the biggest change in the business hasn't even come through the acquisition. It's more just how we've evolved as being a larger company. Like at this point last year, so, you know, March of 2020, we had 34 people. Now the brew has 90 plus people. You know, we'll cross 100 in the next month. We'll be 120 by the end of the year. We'll probably be at high 100s by the end of next year. It's just a fundamentally different company. And that's not a bad thing. It just means it's just different. So there's always this analogy that this guy, Ben Sun, who founded Primary Ventures, a big VC in New York, he's actually a Michigan guy also. And he describes companies or startups in kind of three or four stages where it goes from family to tribe to village to city. And I would very much say that like the last year has been kind of this evolution from tribe to village. The early days of the brew, when we were in a WeWork space, when we were less than 20 people, it was a family. We all knew each other. We were all wearing 15 different hats. We had deep personal relationships. Like there was no division between working together during the day. And then when you go out at night, you're going out with the same people. Then it turned into kind of tribe, which is, you know, everyone. You have personal relationships with everyone, but they're starting to get shallower and you start to see like some subgroups within the company just as it gets bigger. And I would say that was like 20 to 40. And then I would say like where we are now, like in this kind of 50 to 100 range. And I don't know when it goes from village to city. I would guess that it actually stays village for pretty long now. Is now it's like, I know everyone, but not everyone in the company knows everyone. I have personal relationships with some of the people in the company, not with everyone. And so it's a totally different dynamic of running the business, growing the business, managing communication, processes and planning. It looks so different. I think that's just a function of the company growing more so than like the acquisition or any sort of deal itself.
Totally. It's so interesting. I've never heard that, but that makes so much sense. I know we don't have much time, but I want to ask you now, because you've launched your own personal podcast, the Founders Podcast. And I love the concept from what I've read and heard. And can you talk about that just a little bit and why you did it?
Yeah. So the idea, this started during the pandemic and it started as kind of just like a passion project. And the whole idea was, I've always believed really deeply in the value of journaling. I think one, like just writing in general, writing is the best vehicle to thinking clearly. Clearly is the best vehicle to making clear decisions. But also, I think there's this weird dynamic where we have ways to memorialize our personal lives through like taking pictures on your phone, videos on your phone, social media. But there actually aren't great ways to memorialize your professional life, because you leave a job, you lose that email, you lose that entire paper trail. But like your professional life is 50% of your adult life. Like you would hope to, there are probably some really meaningful memories in all that and points of growth. Anyway, I started doing the journaling thing and I just could never build the habit. I was not able to build the habit. And it was kind of frustrating to me because I knew how important it was. So what I said to myself is, if I start creating a podcast that is effectively an audio journal, one, I think it's a really interesting creative format I haven't seen anyone do. And I said, if I'm creating something for an audience, it will hold me accountable to doing this. Like, to me, one of the best ways I force accountability on myself is to not look stupid in front of other people. So I started creating this, at the time, daily podcast. And the whole idea was talking about the biggest lessons, decisions, challenges, emotions I was feeling behind the scenes of Morning Brew. Now it has changed to, it's 3 days a week. I'm spending more time like scripting and researching. It is partly about Morning Brew, but I also talk about things outside of Morning Brew. But the whole concept is, this is the podcast for the business builder. If you're someone who is not just building a company, like you don't have to just be an entrepreneur, you can be an entrepreneur who's building a team or a product within a larger company. To me, business builder encompasses all of those things, intrapreneur and entrepreneur. The whole idea of this podcast is, I talk about things that help you think better in order to build better whatever you're building. And so it's not just about the brew. It's like, you know, I had a recent episode about how we at The Brew are thinking about the future of work and what our work setup is going to be in terms of like remote versus in-person and the trade-offs of that. But like I was just talking about that example of Pinduoduo and Colin Wong, like that's an upcoming episode where I do like a business case study on talking about this company's meteoric rise and what are the lessons we can learn from them as builders. So that's the goal with the podcast.
I love it. I love the idea. I'm going to leave you on tonight. You got Michigan UCLA, right? Elite Eight.
Yep.
What's your prediction? Give me a prediction.
Yeah, this is going to be a totally unbiased prediction.
Sure.
So I was honestly more worried about last game against Florida State. I was even more worried about the previous game against LSU, but that almost makes me feel more anxious about this, the fact I'm less worried. So I'm going to say I'm really worried, but I think we're going to end up on top. No, look, I think Juwan Howard's a great coach. Michigan does not have the most talented team in college basketball right now, not the most athletic, probably going to have, I would say, the least number of players that actually go to the pros of this current squad. But Juwan Howard has built a system where they play incredibly well as a team. And I never want to be one to bet against a team that has an incredible dynamic together. So I'm scared if other teams are playing us.
Yeah. I love that, because talking about Juwan Howard, talking about team and talking about businesses, you've said it on this podcast, how important that is, finding the right people. It's everything. And yeah, you have the wrong ones, it could be a disaster. So in any case, man, Alex, appreciate coming on the show. So great to talk to you. Good luck with everything. Congrats on your deal. And I'm sure we're going to see you running some major, major media company soon enough. Don't beat yourself up to get there.
I'll try not to. Thanks so much for having me. It's been awesome.
All right. Thanks, man.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.